My name's Scott Ritter. I think I'm best known as a weapons inspector with the United Nations Special Commission on Iraq, helping oversee the disarmament of Iraq from 1991 until my resignation in 1998. Prior to that, I was an intelligence officer in the United States Marine Corps. I cut my arms control teeth, actually, with the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union. I was actually the first inspector on the ground in the Soviet Union when that treaty entered into force in July of 1988. And I did that job for 2 years. And after that work, I went back to the Marine Corps, and I got caught up in the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, where I served on the intelligence staff of General Norman Schwarzkopf, the commander-in-chief of coalition forces. And I was involved in counter-scud operations, that is, trying to interdict Iraqi scud missiles before they could be launched against either Israel or targets in the Gulf Arab states. I had what's called a good war, meaning I got a good reputation for being good at what I do. We didn't kill any scuds, but that wasn't for a lack of trying. And I think the combination of my arms control work, my background as an intelligence officer, and the role that I played in hunting down scud missiles made me attractive to the United Nations. And they recruited me in September of 1991 to come in and create an intelligence unit to help navigate the lies that Iraq was telling about its weapons of mass destruction. Iraq was obligated to declare the totality of its holdings. It did not do so. The UN inspectors were at a loss. I was brought in and helped create a very effective intelligence organization and capability that helped UN weapons inspectors actually ferret out 90 to 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. I played a role not just as an intelligence officer, but also as a chief weapons inspector. I was chief weapons inspector for 14 inspections out of the 45 inspections that I conducted in Iraq. And I resigned in 1998, frustrated at the lack of support that we were getting from the United States and from the United Nations. And I gained a reputation as somewhat of a anti-war activist in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003 by pointing out that although Iraq had not been found to be totally in compliant with its obligation to disarm, we had, after all, accounted for 90 to 95% of their holdings, and what remained could not constitute a threat worthy of war. And so I spoke out very aggressively against that war. And since that time, I've been very critical of American foreign policy, both in the Middle East and also in terms of our approach towards arms control. I've been very focused on the issue of Iran and Iran's nuclear programs. And, that seems to be an issue that has come to the forefront today with the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a leading Iranian scientist, nuclear scientist, last Friday.
That's right. Well, I mean, there's so much to talk about. Can we start, though, with the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty? Because this is something which the Russians and the Americans are no longer in. But can you tell us why that is and whose fault it is, you think? What's the motivation for tearing up that treaty? Because I would have thought that, you know, these intercontinental ballistic nuclear weapons are one thing, but the Intermediate Nuclear Forces, we're told, are much more dangerous because they could potentially be used by a field commander, which could trigger a much, much wider war. So they're obviously very important weapons. Can you just take us through why that's fallen apart, that treaty, and who you think's to blame?
Certainly. I'm giving away my age here. It still seems like yesterday, 1978, 79, when the Soviet Union started deploying a new missile system called the SS-20 Pioneer. This was an intermediate nuclear range missile. That is a missile with a range of less than 5,000 kilometers. It had three nuclear warheads, and it was mobile, which made it very difficult to target. And by deploying these missiles into the European theater of operations, they basically placed all of Europe under a Soviet nuclear umbrella, so that if there was ever a conflict that went nuclear, basically the Soviets were in a position to destroy every European city of note. This was a very dangerous thing. And the United States put pressure on NATO to respond by deploying its own intermediate nuclear forces, Pershing 2 missiles and ground-launched cruise missiles. Of these two, the Pershing 2 is particularly dangerous because from its base of operations in West Germany, once launched, a Pershing 2 missile could deliver a sizable nuclear warhead on Moscow within 8 to 9 minutes of launch. Now, when you're talking about intercontinental ballistic missiles and strategic nuclear war, both the United States and the Soviet Union had a period of around 25 to 30 minutes to decide whether or not something they might have detected using a satellite or radar was a false alarm or the real deal. And that buffer actually prevented wars in the past. There's a famous incident where a Soviet officer in the command center detected what appeared to be an intercontinental ballistic missile launch against the Soviet Union. And if he had followed standard operating procedures, he would have authorized the immediate launch of Soviet missiles in retaliation, and that would have been the end of the world. Fortunately, he said, this doesn't feel right, and he waited. And in doing so, they were able to determine that it was a research rocket, not the real deal, and the war was averted. But it's this kind of, hair trigger, status that the world lived under in the 1980s that made getting rid of intermediate nuclear missiles very attractive to both the United States and its NATO allies and the Soviet Union. And this is why they signed in December of 1987 the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Ronald Reagan, no friend of the Soviet Union at that time, and Mikhail Gorbachev desperately looking for, a reduction in the Soviet Union's military budget to help with his restructuring that was taking place in the Soviet Union, signed this treaty. And it was groundbreaking because not only did they get rid of this entire class of missiles, but they implemented what's called on-site inspection. For the first time, as part of the treaty compliance verification protocols, weapons inspectors would be allowed on the soil of the inspected party to not only verify that the declarations were complete, but to oversee the destruction of missiles and their components, and also to monitor missile factories to ensure that the missiles being produced there were not of a prohibited nature. That's the role that I played. I worked outside of a Soviet missile factory for 2 years, monitoring its production of permitted mobile intercontinental ballistic missiles to make sure that they weren't the prohibited intermediate range missiles. This was a very successful treaty. The confidence that it raised between both the Soviet Union and the United States, that neither side was actually seeking to destroy one another, that led to the negotiation and signing of the START Treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, getting rid of these strategic nuclear weapons. And things were going well until the collapse of the Soviet Union. At that time, the United States made a determination that pursuing this kind of stringent arms control was no longer in the best interest of the United States because the Soviet Union had been defeated. The United States viewed Russia as a defeated power and wasn't willing to yield the unilateral advantage it now enjoyed over Russia and indeed over the entire world. And as a result, arms control went into a sort of a hiatus, and with it, the confidence between the Soviet Union and the United States that neither side was seeking to gain an advantage. It now became clear to the Soviets, well, the Russians, that the United States was trying to gain advantage. And this became even more clear in 2001 when President George W. Bush withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. That was a treaty signed in 1972 that pretty much said the best way to guarantee that nuclear weapons are never used is to ensure that there is no adequate defense against them. That way, if they are used, it's mutually assured destruction. Both sides will be annihilated. That's the best deterrence one can have against somebody pushing the trigger. But George W. Bush said, no, the United States is going to pursue missile defense, and we're not going to be constrained by this treaty. We tried to tell the Russians, you don't need to worry about this. We're only building missile defenses that will target North Korean or Iranian or other rogue nations. We're not going to target you or the Chinese. We'd never do that. You can trust us on this one. Well, the Russians never did trust the United States on this one, and for good reason. The United States was lying. Fact is, just last month, we tested a ABM missile, the standard missile 3, as an ICBM killer, violating every pledge we ever gave to the Russians that we would never do something like this. We did it. And it's something that's been in the planning since we withdrew from the ABM treaty back in 2001. We're not a good negotiating partner. We actually cheat. We lie. Ever since we got rid of, truly bilateral arms control, we've been seeking to withdraw from these treaties. We did it with George W. Bush, even under Barack Obama. We did sign an extension of the START treaty called New START, but we were never keeping our word. For instance, to give you an example, one of the ways that we reduce our obligation or the numbers is that we can convert submarine launch ballistic missiles so that launch tubes are irreversibly withdrawn. That means they can never be used again. And the Russians questioned the way we did it. They said, well, wait a minute, what you're doing is actually temporary, that you can change this at any time. And we said, no, don't worry about it. Well, under Donald Trump, just last year, we acknowledged, we can reverse this anytime we want. And the fact is, we're going to reverse it. If the New START treaty isn't extended, we'll just make all those launch tubes good again. That means we lied from day one with the Russians.
With this intermediate nuclear forces treaty, both the Americans are blaming the Russians for it falling apart. The Russians are blaming the Americans. Whose fault do you think it is?
It's 100% the United States. And I'll give you an example. The United States has claimed that the Russians have developed a new cruise missile that has the range that makes it an intermediate nuclear forces weapon. Russia denies this. What's interesting here is that Russia and the United States are allowed to develop sea launch cruise missiles. That is, cruise missiles that can be used on ships, but they can't be tested in a ground only configuration. And it seems that the United States intelligence has misrepresented data from a sea launch cruise missile, and we've interpreted it as being a ground loss cruise missile, and we are just dead wrong. We blame the Russians. We failed to provide any evidence. Finally, we identified the system called the 9M, 79 or something of that nature. And the Russians said, wait, no, here, you can inspect it. They brought it out. They laid it out. They said, come on in and inspect it, and then we can discuss how we can, alleviate your concerns. We refused to participate in that process. Meanwhile, the Russians were accusing the United States of using the ABM treaty to deploy what's called Aegis Ashore, the Mark 41 missile launch system that is normally used on ships. We deployed it on the ground in Poland and Romania. We said we're only going to use it in a surface-to-air configuration, anti-ballistic missile configuration. But the Russians said that same system, when on a ship, can also launch a sea launch cruise missile. You're now putting ground launch cruise missile capable launchers on the soil in Europe. You're in violation. We denied that was even possible. As soon as we withdrew from the treaty in August of 2019, the first thing we did is launch a ground launch cruise missile from a Mark 41 launcher. The United States has never played it straight. We're the ones to blame. Russia has done their best to try and alleviate our concerns. We have done nothing to try and save this treaty, and now the treaty's gone. And the end result is, we are in a situation that's returned us back to the 1980s, where if we deploy intermediate range missiles in Europe, we're back to that nuclear hair trigger. Many people alive today can't even remember what it's like to live under the imminent threat of nuclear annihilation. I do remember. I lived in Europe at the time. I was an inspector. I'm not happy that we're returning to that same situation.
So we've got a new president now. His name is Joe Biden. He's a bit different to Donald Trump in that he does seem to be more like the type of person that will read from an auto cue, teleprompter, his script, rather than speak from the heart. And whatever one might say about Donald Trump and the problems that there's been with him, and my goodness, there's been enough. You know, at least you're getting Donald Trump. You seem to be getting a kind of, I mean, they call him Sleepy Joe. I don't really want to insult the guy, but it's almost like he's kind of reading from a script when he's speaking. A different kind of character anyway, but put it like that. What do you think is likely to be the changes, if any, in the foreign policy of the United States under Biden?
Well, I know Joe Biden. I actually had significant interaction with him when he was a senator and heading up the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We famously clashed during my Senate testimony in September of 1998. He later apologized. We met, and I've called him out since that time for lying about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capability. Joe Biden is a very arrogant, hubris-filled individual who believes he knows best. Robert Gates is famously, who former CIA director and Secretary of Defense, is famously pointed out that Joe Biden has been wrong on every aspect of policy. Every. He hasn't been right on anything. And yet Joe Biden believes that he knows best. He's the smartest man in the room. He may read from a teleprompter, but he's as capable of speaking off the cuff as Donald Trump is. And his arrogance, you know, will show. He was carefully controlled as a candidate, but as president, I don't think that kind of, you know, the restraints are off. He's now president. There's nothing to lose, and we're going to see the old Joe Biden come out. And he commits foot and mouth violations on a frequent basis. He's surrounded by a team of professionals who also believe they are the smartest people in the room, that they know best. They believe that the last 4 years has been an exercise in national embarrassment and that their task is to come in and lead America out of the wilderness, so to speak. You know, but these people, you know, they may appear to look good when contrasted with the Trump foreign policy team. But when you realize that their roots are in policy failures that took place in the Clinton administration, policy failures that took place in the Obama administration, their resumes aren't that good. And when you combine their failed record with Joe Biden's arrogance, I don't believe that that we are going to be in the in a honeymoon period. I don't think that American foreign policy is going to be what Europe and American allies in the Pacific and elsewhere are hoping it will be. I think you're going to see that Joe Biden is as arrogant as Donald Trump. The problem is he's surrounded by people that believe they know best, and they're not the kind of people that that seek advice or take advice.
I mean, you're pretty well versed with the details of Iran and its supposed nuclear weapons program. That's at least what the Israelis will say. One of the most important agreements on the planet is this JCPOA. Some will say it's the only thing really standing between us and war, potentially, in the Middle East, between Iran and Israel. Do you think there's going to be any chance of the United States rejoining that treaty, or will Israel actually allow the U.S. to do that with Biden in charge?
If Joe Biden wanted to rejoin the agreement, it's not a treaty. It's an agreement, at least from the perspective of U.S. law. It was never ratified by the United States Senate. So it came into power via executive order only. And that's why Trump was able to get out of it so easily. All Joe Biden has to do is issue an executive order saying that we're rejoining. He's not going to do that. Not because Israel is stopping him. A lot of people don't remember the hostility that existed between the Obama administration and Israel over the issue of Palestine and settlements and things of that nature. So, you know, Biden's coming in with a history of looking askance at Israel. That doesn't mean that he's going to be anti-Israel, but it doesn't mean he's going to be as pro-Israel as Donald Trump is. Joe Biden is one who believes that the nuclear agreement was a good deal at the time it was signed. Indeed, the man that he's picked to be his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, was the vice president, then Vice President Biden's national security advisor. and played an important role in getting the negotiations off the ground and helping make possible the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action. So, you know, Biden is naturally inclined to be supportive of this. The problem is that there's been, you know, nearly 3 years now, I mean, 2+ years of the United States not being a part of this agreement. And since that time, Iran has exercised its right under Articles 26 and 36 of this agreement, which basically say that when a party to the agreement is not in compliance, the other party may withdraw from its obligations legally. And Iran has rightfully said that not only has the United States withdrawal shown noncompliance, but that Europe has failed to live up to its obligations under the agreement to engage in economic interaction with Iran, fearing secondary sanctions from the United States if they do business with Iran. So the Iranians have rightfully pointed out that Europe has failed to live up to its obligations, and therefore Iran has backed away from its commitments under the JCPOA. Now, it is said that this reversal, that everything it's done is easily reversed, that should Europe and the United States come back into compliance, should sanctions be lifted, Iran would immediately return to compliance. But the fact of the matter is, as we speak today, one of the important things of the JCPOA was this one-year breakout window. This was a very important calculation put forward by Barack Obama that said the purpose of the agreement, the sole purpose of the agreement, is to create the conditions in Iran so that if Iran decided they weren't going to cooperate, from that point, it would take them a minimum of 1 year to enrich enough uranium to produce a single nuclear weapon. Well, guess what? Because Iran has backed out, we're at the point right now where that breakout period has been reduced to a period of months, if not weeks. Now, that doesn't mean that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons capability. The fact is, there's definitely no evidence that Iran is doing that today. And there's the evidence that Israel and the United States relies on that says Iran was pursuing a nuclear weapons capability. By both sides' admission, that evidence ceased to be viable in 2003. They're saying there's no doubt from 2003 onward, Iran is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. And that includes today. So, you know, we're talking strictly hypotheticals here, but hypotheticals play politically. And right now, the American domestic political reality is that there is a belief that Iran has positioned itself to produce a nuclear weapon in a very short period of time, and that the nuclear agreement is insufficient to the task of containing Iran's nuclear ambition. Therefore, it's going to be virtually impossible for Joe Biden to rejoin this agreement politically. He will be attacked from the left and the right, and the last thing he wants is a crisis of this nature, right, immediately upon assuming.
I mean, surely the Iranians can, you know, literally scrap whatever it is they've been up to and come back into compliance and almost, you know, dare Joe Biden not to rejoin if they're back in compliance in Iran.
Well, we'll see what Iran does. I mean, I you know, if Iran has been saying that what they've been doing is reversible, but I don't see Iran taking the first step. As Iran has pointed out, they didn't quit the agreement. The United States did. Therefore, it's incumbent upon the United States to return to the agreement. And once the United States does return, then Iran will verifiably reverse everything. But I don't think Iran's going to play the game that it has to come back into compliance first. You know, we'll see. One of the interesting things is that Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, the future Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, have both reconsidered the issue of sanctions and said, hey, you know, when we first did this agreement back in 2015, we were of the belief that sanctions couldn't work. And therefore, that's why we had to get an agreement, because the only alternative was war. But after we've taken a look at what Trump has been doing with his maximum pressure campaign, we think there might be more room for sanctions to work. And so there's a renewed belief that sanctions against Iran could be useful in compelling Iran to return to the negotiating table. And I think that that's the direction we're heading, that the United States is going to try and wait Iran out by continuing sanctions, imposing more sanctions, it's going to be interesting how they do this and maintain good relations with Europe. Because, you know, one of the big sticking points in the United States and Europe are these secondary sanctions, where the United States sanctions Europe for doing business with Iran. You know, so Biden's going to have to, he's got a delicate balancing act here, but I don't see him immediately rejoining the agreement. I see him trying to place pressure on Iran to provide some sort of commitment to not only coming back into compliance, but then immediately renegotiating this agreement for even more stringent terms. Iran says we already did the negotiation and we already got the terms. We're happy with the terms. The world was happy with the terms. Only the United States isn't happy with the terms, and they're not inclined. Whether or not.
Yeah. Sounds to me like what you're saying is there's no going back, or it's unlikely that we'd be going back there. Anyway, look, finally, I thought I'd ask you about the pandemic, Scott, even though I know you're really, when it comes to WMD, you're probably hotter on the nukes than you are on the Novichoks or the anthrax or whatever. But what do you make of this? Because there is some accusations that it could be a bioweapon, this COVID-19. And the origins, what do you think? Because it's obviously caused a bit of a stir and right around the world. This is unprecedented, isn't it?
Well, it is unprecedented. I'm limited to the information that I have access to. I have done my best to read the reports that the Chinese have prepared, and that's always a risky thing, given that the accusation is that China cooked this up in a bio lab, and that they're to blame. But the Chinese have put forward a logical explanation for what happened in China, meaning their story matches the facts on the ground. Who got infected first? Where the infection took place? Etc. And China also provides a logically constructed narrative on the analysis that took place, how they it was identified as a COVID type virus, but there's a half dozen COVID viruses. The common cold is a COVID virus. They weren't able to isolate this as COVID-19 until I think the first week in January, and then they determined that it was able to go aerosol, meaning that it spread via air vector, person to person, and they reported this. So it's not like the Chinese have been hiding things. I still believe that the evidence shows that this is not made in a military lab. But what China hasn't been able to do yet is give us ground zero. They can give us ground zero in China, but what they've said is that it came from somewhere else, that they were not the origin of this. And that's where the data stands. Now, if the US, the UK, or anybody else has intelligence that says otherwise, they haven't presented it to the public. So, right now I can only go on the data that is available, and that data seems to support the Chinese version of events. That doesn't mean that that's the final answer. China could be lying. And there might be other information out there that the intelligence.
Okay, because it's been an unprecedented clampdown on civil liberties. Some people are saying, well, this is really little worse than a bad flu season in terms of death rates from this. And yet the whole world's been locked down. What do you make of the civil society reaction and the fact that so many countries, particularly Europe and the United States, have really taken away so many civil liberties? And it seems until apparently there's going to be a vaccine. We've had this Pfizer vaccine announced this week as approved for use in the UK. But many are also pointing out that the death rate is so low that the vaccine may be not worth having. And also many, of course, doctors will say that, particularly for elderly people, I've been speaking to an immunologist, Dr. Stanley Laham at the University of Florida. He says he won't have the flu vaccine because he believes that some of the consequences of having it are worse than what it protects you from. And also that the flu vaccines tend to be a lag. So in other words, they're not even up to date with the current flu. So anyway, what do you make of these the clampdown and the idea of sort of mass vaccinations for this?
Well, I'm a huge civil liberties proponent. I believe the Constitution of the United States, and I believe that, you know, England has a very strong record of human rights. You know, are things that just can't be violated at will. And so, if you're going to undertake the kind of repressive, restrictive policies that are, you know, underway in the UK and the United States and elsewhere in Europe, there's got to be reason, fact-based. I'm a numbers guy. I'm a data guy. And the one thing I can say is, A, I'm not an expert on this, but B, just looking at the data that's presented, you know, it changes on an almost weekly basis. A different model has been refuted, this, that. You know, so if you're going to come after me and say that I'm going to restrict your liberties, but then the data you use to do that is ever changing, I'm inclined to say, no, you're not going to restrict my liberties, that you need to have a much more persuasive case than the one you're making. Maybe the data is out there, but it's so confusing in the way the governments are presenting it. It sounds like they don't even understand the data they're working on. They don't understand how, you know, casualty rates are being calculated. There's no consistency in the approach in data collection and data analysis among countries. So it's hard to get a genuine singular picture of COVID-19 and the health threat that it poses, because governments have been, you know, so hit and miss on how they describe it and the data they use. So you know, look, I want everybody to be safe. I want us to get through this. But you know, an important part of what makes America America is its civil liberties. And if they're telling me that to survive this pandemic, I have to give up my civil liberties, I'm somebody who was willing to die in combat to protect these things. So you know what? I'm not willing to surrender them that easily, especially when the argument is so weak.
Scott Ritter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.